Hello, everyone. We are now live from London and New York, and I would like to welcome our guests, colleagues, partners joining us from all around the world for this important conversation. So this call is part of the Teneo Insights series, an initiative to bring together speakers and experts on the most pressing subjects of the time that we are living through. And today is quite a day because it marks 1 month since the invasion of Ukraine, 1 month of war in Europe. And I want to recognize this day and encourage all our listeners to hold a moment of silence for the people who have suffered. It is at times of these global crises that corporate crises become more acute as well, and crisis boardrooms, crisis war rooms are in full gear, which is why we're here to speak about crisis preparedness and management, a topic that has gained extraordinary popularity since early 2020 and steadily rising up the charts. My name is Elisa, and I lead the Teneo Risk EMEA team, a group of experts bound by, well, one goal, to help organizations and companies have a less bad time when a crisis hits. On this call, I'll try to share some current multi-industry observations about the state of crisis systems, leadership, and hope to give our listeners some very practical steps and advice to take, well, as soon as this afternoon, hopefully. I am joined by Juliette Kayyem, an extraordinary woman in the field of crisis management. We are lucky to have her as our senior advisor at Teneo. Juliette is joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts today, and we have to share her with any number of very important places, like the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where she teaches crisis management, the CNN as a national security analyst, and she was previously with the Department of Homeland Security. Today, she's here about a week before her new book on crisis leadership comes out, and I am the lucky recipient of an early copy. And it is really fabulous. So, Juliette, please tell us about your journey in the field of crisis management and about your upcoming book.
Thank you so much. It is great to be here. Great to see you. And it's been tremendous working with Teneo and the team. And grateful for those who have logged in this morning here, but afternoon elsewhere. So we're going to talk through some of the lessons we both have had in our experiences. My work has been in both the public and private sector, and also in communications. And so this book is really about learning to fail safer. I think it's about thinking about the standards of success differently, and the lessons that can be learned from centuries of disasters, right? In other words, we tend to think of disasters as unique and these moments that are unprecedented is the common term. And the problems may not follow a pattern or consistency, but in my studies, actually the solutions do. And that's good. That should give us power and faith and lessons learned. So I should just say, you know, in disaster management, our world is very simple. We have only two times. We think of a boom, any event that could happen. So the book and my work and your work is threat agnostic. It could be cyber, pandemic, terrorist Absolutely. Attack. And we think of, you know, left of boom investments, which are those to prevent and protect the bad things from happening, and right of boom investments to respond and recover and repair. And this book is really focused on that moment of the boom, actually, right here, right now. What do we wish we had done to minimize the losses? And as you said, to make things less bad with the expectation that we won't be able to stop the devil's arrival every single time. And so the front part of the book are those insights, and then the rest is eight lessons about how we can think better about that moment of the boom to minimize the damage and harm.
And did you use a lot of the examples that you've gone through yourself in your career in the book?
Yeah, it's both. I mean, I think one of the things that was interesting to me, and I'm sure you start to see this being in the field for a while, is just the consistency of both sort of what worked and what doesn't work, and then over centuries, and then also in my own experience, so both in the public and the private sector as consulting, particularly through COVID, where the challenges for CEOs were so essential and important, and you saw some able to pivot and communicate and engage in ways that really help their employees and help their company, and others that did not. And one of my favorite stories of the book is, a reviewer called it chatty, and I did not view that as a criticism, because I want it to be accessible to people who would never think I have a book on disaster management or crisis management. But one of the remarkable things, or one of the things that is important to remember, is in Fukushima, which is one of the greatest nuclear disasters, is to remember that there was actually a nuclear facility also impacted by the earthquake and the tsunami, not far from Fukushima, that had practiced failing safer. In other words, they understood that they were a high-risk industry. So is aviation. So are many things of our clients and others that are in. You can't talk about zero risk, but learned to fail safer and was able to essentially turn off the nuclear facility without any radiation leak. And so comparing these two, we forget the good news story. No one knows of this other nuclear facility, but comparing the two actually becomes a way of thinking, okay, both encountered the devil, the unanticipated or the anticipated but unlikely, and one was able to sort of to essentially minimize the worst possibility, which was radiation leaks. And so, I mean, I sort of turn to you, those commonalities. You know, sometimes you're sort of probably looking at things and going, oh my God, this is, you know, if only they had listened to me before. But those commonalities do strike me as, if you've been in the field long enough, as more important than the differences.
Yeah, I think the commonalities are really resounding. And now with crisis management, crisis preparedness as an idea, they're really popular. Yeah. And, you know, everyone I work with really is like, yes, we're improving this, we're looking at this. But yet the commonalities between the challenges are really sort of striking. And I actually, right before this call, was thinking, well, what are those commonalities? And would be happy to sort of share through them and see if you've experienced the same.
Yeah.
But firstly, is organizations and companies need to define a crisis. And if you actually haven't defined what a crisis is for you, it's going to be a challenge because you don't know what you're solving. So anybody who's listening to us, have a look, or even, you know, later make a note to have a look at your company's crisis definition. If you cannot find the words people, systemic level, threat to existence of, or ability to fulfill mission, then there is a challenge, right? You need to define a crisis as something suitably existential that threatens your organization's ability to continue doing what it's supposed to be doing. And then secondly, if you're tuning in from enterprise risk management to this call, or communications, crisis comms, business continuity risk, and you don't really know those other colleagues, what everyone does, what everyone's responsible for, then probably your company or business has a very sort of siloed approach to resilience functions, right? One resilience umbrella, one spectrum, and those functions belong together, or at least working in very, very close proximity to be able to manage a crisis. Juliet, you spoke about threat agnostic.
Yeah.
Plans and approaches. We're still seeing things that look like cyber incident plans,
oh my
pandemic
God,
plans,
yeah.
Bribery plan, right? Like, don't even get me started about the language around that, but there is a lot of work to do there. So a good plan is threat agnostic.
Yeah. I think that's so key. I mean, if I could do anything, you know, when a company calls me, or I go in and look at, my first question is always, what do the bones look like? What's your architecture like? Because as you've seen, and I'm sure this will resonate with a lot of people, so, you know, after 9/11, we all have our chief security officers. And then as the internet rises, you have your chief information security officer. Now, after COVID, some of major retail chains, restaurant chains have, you know, chief public health officer, chief medical officer. And you're like, okay, that's a lot of focus on the risk. The response is essentially going to be the same, or 80% the same. Of course, a cyber attack is different than a pandemic coming, you know, from Asia, but it's not the skills that leadership needs in terms of planning, communication, situational awareness, engagement. Those are consistent. And my frustration that sort of related in the book is we spend so much time sort of, you know, building for the threat, and then like so much less time, we sort of walk away when we, you know, or sort of don't think about the connective tissue amongst all these other threats. If I were redesigning a major company now, after we look at the bones, right? Where is mm-hmm. everyone? Who do they report to? I am now beginning to think that companies should have driven overall, like sort of chief preparedness officer, of which these different risks are feeding into, because it's really the preparedness that is going to impact how great the risk is, right? So, you know, if you're prepared for the pandemic, if you're prepared for the hurricane, then your consequences will be less bad than they might otherwise have been. But so I begin with architecture. I mean, but everyone focuses on budget, like that's important, right? How much are you spending on X, Y, and Z? But I actually think that you can't have good preparedness without good bones. And I think so many companies are sort of invested in these structures that if they could just think, let me just restart, how would I actually want to think about this? I'd want to elevate someone who's looking, you know, across, right, the non-business risk, right, or the outside risk that could impact the business of the company.
Definitely. And yeah. As part of that architecture, I would also have a more of a crisis HR infrastructure as well, yeah. Because what used to be caring for the people, caring, you know, meeting your duty of care commitments used to be really part of the extractive right. industry, heavy industries, right, where we're definitely going to have people problems. But now even the pandemic has shown us, the post-pandemic world has shown us that we need more of an infrastructure to support our people. Yes. And that could be when you're accounting for our people, supporting them individually, supporting them as groups, and looking at that as part of the preparedness framework as well.
Yeah, someone told me yesterday they had an incident, actually a U.S. company in Fukushima, and told me that the HR team ended up being the heroes because the HR team knew where all the American employees were. This was in a U.S. company, mm-hmm. where they live and could make sure that they were okay. And you're thinking, yeah, like that's actually integrating your crisis management into HR. I think the question I have for you, though, the challenge I still have as we talk through sort of some of the changes is, you know, there's like this idea of the sort of new normal and hopefully knock on wood where, you know, these new waves of the virus are going to be less lethal and will constantly be adapting. But UI and everyone in the Teneo risk team, you know, sort of believes in perpetual preparedness. But it does remain a challenge with the sort of human sentiment to move on and to question the need for these kinds of an investment. And I'm curious if you're starting to sort of crisis readiness already beginning to sort of have to step aside to the core competency of these companies that they often don't view as crisis or preparedness.
Yeah, I expect those clients to become my future clients very, 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 very quickly, those who are deciding to move on. Yeah. I think, and there is occasionally sort of very, very little you can do because the sentiment in the boardroom, how the boardroom is, how the executives think and feel and believe the crisis preparedness should be done in its important levels is how it cascades through the entire organization. So at field level and ground level, it's going to look exactly the same as it looks at the core of the company. The companies that I am seeing actually over index on the preparedness now are those who have had a reasonably rubbish time through COVID and after COVID events, through recent crises, through cyber crises in particular. And those are looking at building global resilience infrastructures from scratch or from, you know, come in, look at the systems, rip them apart, build it new. And those are my absolutely favorite projects to be involved with because I know that when the situation happens, they are going to be the ones who are, you know, national crisis centers, will be putting them on pedestals and saying, yes, everyone, please do like these guys. You know, go learn something about crisis management from them.
I mean, just on that point, like, you know, part of the book is to also, and my work, you know, on, you know, is, and when you come into companies is to sort of, you know, raise the curtain on something, disaster management, crisis management, that had every incentive to keep itself not transparent, either because, you know, think about these cybersecurity companies that are, you know, trying to convince other companies that they have the gizmo that's going to stop any cyber attack, which we know is not true. And, you know, there's a desire to specialize. And I think COVID taught us, like, actually, we have to sort of democratize crisis management, because that's the most successful, when people engage, when they're helping each other, when they're seeing the benefits. And so part of sort of collective action. And so part of thinking about success is I think the public tends to view, you know, sort of success is, did we stop the bad thing from happening, right? So, and failure is, the bad thing happened. And I think what we have to do is sort of reframe what success is, which is, I'm anticipating the bad thing and I'm going to learn to fail safer, to save people, to save property, to save business reputation, to save a budget or, you know, capital. All of those are important.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to make a brief announcement to our listeners. Yeah. Dear listeners, we would love to answer your questions towards the end of this call. So please use the Q&A function to send us your questions. And we will be more than happy to turn our conversation into whatever interests you the most, whatever would be more valuable. And then, Juliette, what about if we spend sort of the next little while, okay, walking through some of those commonalities that, yeah, you mentioned in the beginning stages of a crisis? So even before a crisis hits, what's important, and then it's, yeah, peak crisis, and then maybe, as
okay,
we know,
we'll
the crisis
through,
is,
yeah, we'll
escalating.
I'll just be very quick with these, and we all have our lessons learned, but so I say, you know, where are the bones, where's the money, where are you? Those are the first three questions you can ask right now as a leader. So one is that idea of architecture. I cannot stress it enough that if you can align a company's preparedness in terms of its reporting structures, in terms of its focus around all hazards or sort of threat agnostic, the better off you will be, because the skills, it's all the same. Like, I, you know, where I'm disclosing too much here, but it's, you know, it's not, as I say, it's not rocket science. We're not making a vaccine here. The second is to look at a budget, and I, you know, you could do back of envelope stuff. You know, overall, it's hard to say what a security budget should be. But I say you have 100 pennies that are focused on sort of what you might generically call sort of risk, safety, security, preparedness. Look at how those pennies are spent on left of boom and right of boom. And what you'll probably see relatively quickly is, I've got a lot on prevention, especially in the cyberspace. I'm spending money, mm-hmm, on, you know, trying to stop the breach, and a lot less on response. So you can begin to do that now, begin to shift in terms of what you're going to invest in. And then the third and most important from a leadership perspective is, where am I? And I say that both, my first chapter is called Get Your Head Around It, right? In other words, we're all crisis managers. But as importantly, in security, we say, you know, is the safety team accessible, right, to the leadership? Or is the leadership accessible to the safety team? I tell a quick anecdote in the book. I'll end here, but it's so telling, and it might resonate with teams on the call. I asked a CEO of a Fortune 200 company, just out of curiosity, I was really curious, how often do you meet with your COO? And he said, you know, twice a day. And I said, well, your CFO? He said, twice a week. And I said, your lawyer? He goes, when I have to, right? And I said, well, what about your chief security officer? And he literally said, he's former FBI, he knows what he's doing. You would never, like, that would be intolerable for a CEO to say that for fiscal, operational, or legal needs. And I think part of it is the sense, like, well, I can delegate that. You can't. So when I talk about accessibility, as well. So you can do that today. I mean, you can actually look and see, you know, what can we do? That's what I would do sort of in the moments before the boom. Do you have similar?
Those anecdotes scare me. But yes, I imagine it's not the only one as such. So I'll carry on this. So you spoke a lot about even before the trigger phase.
Yeah.
I'll take it through to the trigger phase.
Yeah, that's great.
So when, let's say we're not even certain that we are in a crisis, and you never are at the beginning, prudent internal overreaction is the name of the game, right? Yeah. It's very easy to stand down a mobilization. It is impossible to gain control once the crisis is definitely a crisis and you have missed the moment to mobilize. So that's probably my number one lesson. Then I work with a lot of teams, and typically most companies get the very first steps right, right? We're talking about gathering information, situational awareness, lots of questions, getting experts in the room, statements, right? Getting out there with a voice. Everybody has learned a lot over the past couple of years. Most companies are doing that. What isn't being done still, and I would recommend that those become sort of priority at the trigger phase of a crisis, is setting an objective. And Juliette, you mentioned that right off the bat. I even wrote it down. Standards of success.
Yeah.
Right? Right. What are your standards of success for this failure? Right? Are we maintaining trust? Are we supporting victims? Are we trying to refute allegations? What is the end point? Because at the peak of the crisis, your ability to respond is going to be outstripped, and you need to be meeting those objectives with the resource you have available. Waiting too late to scenario plan. I tend to get calls from organizations who've been in a state of crisis maybe for a week or two, and then say, oh, Lisa, it's time to do some scenario planning. And I say, no, time to do scenario planning was the moment that you have issued an initial statement. Because seeing through how this situation is likely to evolve will allow you to actually meet the demands of it better and not be so reactive.
Yeah.
And finally, right. I mean, a bit lightly, but I always advise my clients to do a quick demon check. Right? As the response unfolds, the worst types of your own personalities or of team personalities come out and hamper the approach. Right? If I had four demons to pick, it would be the control freak. I know best. I'm the only person able to do the response.
Yeah.
The response is funneled through one individual. You are very slow. It's basically invalid and doesn't include any ground thinking and cultural nuance. Or the fear monger, where, oh, well, maybe it's not a crisis, maybe it'll blow over, no way. And that really slows the response from starting at the appropriate time. It's Kevin the teenager with, oh, mom, life is so unfair, this is unfair, this crisis is unfair, I don't want to, you know, and that is a very defensive response that a team could bring. Or the lunatic, right? Like, wow, loving this crisis, let's not use the crisis plan, let's make a new one, this is totally different. And then you're basically flying an aircraft, changing the engines while you're flying, and you know the result of that. So do a quick demon check at the trigger phase of the crisis.
That's excellent. That is so true. Well, and I think part of, I mean, just picking up on what you do a lot in terms of overcoming those demons, or one way to make sure those demons don't pop up is actually having a level of understanding of what's likely to happen when the crisis happens. You don't, as a leader or CEO or whatever, you're not the incident commander, so to speak. You're not deploying resources. Hopefully you're not. But one thing I've seen is, you know, if you think about the two of the personality traits that you described are what we call, you know, in the wonky world, sort of intervention bias and abdication bias, right? So intervention is I'm gonna become the tactical operator. Both of those are, I think, have experienced because leadership does not actually know what's going on. So they either intervene because they have no confidence, or because they can't handle the strategic thinking that's required of them. So they're like, okay, well, I'll be the nitpicky one, or they advocate and blame everyone else because they simply are not aware of their responsibility. And so you can overcome that relatively easy. These are not I don't, I'm not going to say it's not rocket science, but these are features that if only you put yourself in that moment. There goes a fire truck outside my house. I apologize if you hear that. It's not my house. I'm just making sure it's not my house. If you only sort of commit to that responsibility, the responsibility actually becomes much easier than if you think the devil's never coming, right? Or that's mm-hmm. not my responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Let's keep traveling. So right now, peak of crisis.
Okay.
Situation is relentless. Our teams are working flat out.
Yeah.
The speed, scale, and impact are overwhelming because that's yeah. really sort of crisis. What's your advice at this stage? So, that's like the boom, right?
Yeah, this is like the, and also it's the capacity to think ahead. So a measure of success, as we keep talking about, is can I minimize the cascading losses, or what we call a fail-safe system? In other words, if something is bad now, trust me, it could be worse. And so what you have to do is sort of anticipate, think of Fukushima, right? So a destroyed nuclear reactor from an earthquake is bad. Guess what? It could get worse if you have radiation leak. One of my favorite examples in the book is the Super Bowl blackout here in the United States. We had a Superdome go half dark with over 100 million people watching on air because of some of the training and planning that they had done. Anticipating worst case scenarios, they had a system that could essentially catch itself and stop the cascading losses and keep the Superdome in half light. So people on the outside are thinking this is a disaster, the lights have gone out. People on the inside are all thinking this is a success because the comparative advantage of half light, including communications to people who might otherwise have been panicked, end up being key. And so just thinking about what those worst case scenarios are in the moment of the boom, and then mm-hmm. preparing for stopping those cascading losses. Of course, that can be done before the disaster, but one of the most important things is, because you're in the moment and it seems overwhelming, is your inability to think about tomorrow. That's why you want a planning team, and you want to be doing all of those and that would be success, right? A Superdome in half light is success.
Yeah, and continuing to scenario plan even as you are responding, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult. But also, I find the peak crisis stage actually incredibly iterative, right?
Yeah.
Most of the hard work happens right before the boom, so way left of the boom, then a little bit at the trigger, right? When you're getting those, you're firing up those processes. And then the middle bit is sort of a glorified, even like over-consulted washing machine, where really you're taking in new information, checking up on your objective, carrying out the actions, and enabling that creativity to think ahead because this process is nearly automated. And of course, listening, right? Feedback loops, not just putting information out there, but checking up on constantly via every available source how this information is being received by the stakeholders. Because the win is for the stakeholders to give you the time and the trust to go sort out the problem.
Yeah.
Even if they want it gone immediately.
Yeah. And that's exactly right.
Yeah. And for us in my work, I do not go a single meeting without mentioning the 4 C's framework, right? Mm-hmm. If you do nothing else, if you think about anything else, it's the 4 C's, right? It's your concern, control, commitment, context. You cannot go an inch further without concern. In every situation, and in particular in situations of cyber, when companies go to adopt this victimized mentality of, oh, we've been hacked, we've been violated. No, we have concern for our users and concern for the data and concern for the people. Moving on to control, what are we doing right now, right this moment? Commitment, what are we going to do to reduce the chances of happening again? How are we going to actually learn and become better from this? And context, only where it's appropriate. And this is some additional information which might impact the way that you think about this situation, but obviously not always appropriate.
Yeah.
So, not sort of forgetting those bits in peak crisis.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, let's say the stakeholders are listening. The situation is de-escalating, sort of, do we just breathe out, stand down the team, business as usual, everyone comes back?
Well, you know, so we talk about, one hopes, right, is that we talked about before sort of learning in real time, being able to pivot, not so tied to the plans, thinking about how situational awareness can help you address not just what you need today, but what you need. So if your metric of success is satisfied, you're able to stop the cascading losses and the what we call in disaster management, stupid deaths, right? Those that did not have to occur except but for the bad government or private sector response. We then look back, and I'm very, you know, we can talk about after action reports and assessing. And the line that I always am drawn to, this is more in disaster management rather than private sector, but is that people die. And I learned this after the major tsunami in the Indian Ocean, that people die is a given. How they die is our responsibility. And so think about hurricanes now. More people here in the United States, we've gotten so sophisticated in our hurricane preparedness, we're kind of fine. People are not drowning. I don't mean that negligent. So most people die now in hurricanes from carbon monoxide poisoning. They set up makeshift generators. Those generators either catch on fire. So you're thinking about, okay, so if you say 40 people died during hurricane season, well, that's gonna, you know, that's true. But how they died, right? So drilling down on sort of what was responsible, in fact, for their death, then makes you rethink what your, in the US case, what your hurricane preparedness planning would be. The same was true of the tsunami in the Indian Ocean. It was not true that if you were close to the water, you inevitably died. And if you were far away, you weren't at the moment of the boom. I don't mean that, obviously, if you were close to the water, it was harder to survive. But actually, there were lessons learned, passed on for decades amongst the island people in Indonesia and Thailand, that when the waters were too still, which is what they noticed that morning after the earthquake, run for the hills. So when the waters recede, essentially run to the hills. Well, this was not known to immigrants or, of course, to tourists who were mm-hmm. visiting, and that's why Western European tourists got hit so bad during the tsunami. They see the ocean recede and they think either it's interesting or that there's nothing to react to. So how people died becomes essential in terms of what our next planning should be. And you could take that to, you know, what happened to the company or whatever, but thinking about our obligation. Yeah, I'm sure you see, I mean, I'd be curious, the best and the worst of sort of after actions for businesses, because, you know, everyone's worried they're going to lose their job, which inevitably some people will, and maybe they should. But you know, a lot of CEOs do not last major catastrophes, if you think. BP, absolutely. Boeing. I mean, you sort of have to kind of accept that. It's a responsibility of consequence of having the job.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even getting that question, will you resign? Yeah. Are you going to take full responsibility for it? Is number one question to prepare for if you're presiding over a crisis. And then you have one of two ways, right? If you've already decided, if that is the option of the board has kindly asked you to, well, then you do it. Or secondly, you know, I want to weather the storm. Yeah. This is my responsibility. This is, I am here. It happened on my watch and I want to be here to rectify it. After that, let the company leadership take its course.
Yeah.
And that's sort of an elegant way out in those cases.
It's funny you say that, because like when the BP oil spill hit, the first questions for President Obama while I was working him were, you know, is this your Hurricane Katrina? And the fact the questions even asked, like, it doesn't matter what your answer is, like, you're already in a frame or having to respond to a framing that is very difficult to get out of.
Yeah.
But I will say to that, sort of thinking about sort of in the US, the BP bill, it was horrible, lots of consequences, but then got their act together, much more stakeholder engagement, much more responsiveness. So that one measure of success is when you think of President Obama, you do not think of the BP oil spill. which compared to, say, President Bush, where you tend to think about, at least in part, Hurricane Katrina and that response. So the failure to talk about it ends up being a success.
Yeah. The only, I guess, bits I have to add to that de-escalation, right, when everyone just wants to, in Tony's own words, have their life back.
Yes. Right?
When everybody wants to do that, I think it's important to go through the review processes, but then don't just dump them, feed them into the risk management process, you know, complete that cycle and give yourself a much better chance of the next crisis. Keep the paper trails tight. You will need this. You will need this in all sorts of things, you know, legal including. So that was our brief whistle-stop tour.
I know.
Crisis life cycle. And we have actually lots of questions.
Oh, good.
Lots of questions coming in, Juliet. So I'm going to try to get us to answer as many as we can. So let me do the moderation
here. Okay, good.
Since you recommended the crisis preparedness officer, I'm really hoping that all of our listeners are already drawing up job specs, because the next question is, what kind of background or skill set would you recommend for crisis preparedness officer? Who would that person be?
Oh gosh, that's preparedness officer, because you know, you don't have to be, preparedness is related to crisis. I mean, you would want someone who both had done operations, so I think that's benefited me in my career. Done operations, but then at some stage, management, business, or strategy, that you can then take the bigger picture. You don't want someone coming straight off the line. I think that would be, you know, the front line, because I think that would be hard. But I think it's more or less
great communicator.
Communicator. But I think it's actually a couple things. You want an adult. I know that sounds weird, but this is a job where you're going to have to convince people not in your chain of command or above your chain of command that what you're doing are the core attributes. So you want someone who is, when I say adult, I mean, in other words, someone who's going to be able to, sort of get in the room, because a lot of times companies are not that, I think. And then the last thing would be a person who can execute on strategy in the absence of a lot of handholding, and that is, I think, just key. So it'd be someone more senior, and you'd want them to be, and then you could think like your chief security officer or CISO or chief medical officer. They're more your sort of frontline intelligence, like in other words, they're telling you what's going on, right, and in terms of what the threat environment is and what capacity is, but they are not, I guess, overseeing all different risks. So that's how I would think about it.
We have a follow-on question from that. What types of functions and key people would you need for a crisis management team?
Yeah.
I'd say broadly, you need three types of people.
Good.
People who know crisis management, right? Crisis as a discipline, those commonalities, how crises evolve and what to do. People who know the business and represent each aspect each core aspect of the business appropriately. And people who know this particular type of situation, that subject matter experts. If we're dealing with a pandemic, with a disaster, with an earthquake, massive data problem, you need that kind of expert in the room as well. When you've covered those three areas of people, you have the chance of having a pretty agile and creative crisis management team, because it's all about sort of, yes, it's going through the plan, but it's the creativity of the specific solution that only the plan can allow you to exercise. Would you agree, Juliet?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that's, I actually wrote those down, because one of the things I loved about what you said is that we tend to think about crises as sort of a unique or specialized skill. And I like that you said, it's just, you said just a discipline, right? I mean, it's just a discipline. It is not, and it is important that someone be trained in it, but it's also important that people outside of it don't view it as sort of so specialized that they can't have some ownership over it and some, you know, basically enforcement or elevation. I think I opened my book or part of my book just for people to understand why people like us are sort of, you know, trying to sort of open up the doors and sort of make people realize this is just a discipline. It's like law. It's like finance. It's nothing, you know, as I said, we're not making rockets. Is to disabuse ourselves of the very definition of disaster. I had never looked the word up. I think I've talked to you about this. It was one of these aha moments, but it's so obvious. Dis means not, and astro is of the stars. So we would view disasters and define disasters as a misalignment of the stars. And that puts mankind and womankind or the human species in a very passive role, right? In other words, mm-hmm. we're just mm-hmm. at the mercy of a misalignment. And actually, it's a discipline. Like you can control it. So if we can take surprise, the devil never sleeps, out of disaster and disaster management, that's success.
Yeah. Let's do another question. What about hybrid structures or permanent work from home arrangements where crisis management is concerned? Do those marry up?
I don't know what you're seeing. I'm now beginning to think that, I mean, the work from home phenomenon, we'll see how long it lasts. I think it'll be more hybrid. I like yesterday, I was at work all day. Today, I'm home. Those like both compatible. But it's going to put a lot more pressure on situational awareness. That's going to be the biggest challenge, I think, because when you're in a room during a crisis and you're sort of absorbing sort of where people are and what's happening, think of sort of an active shooter situation, sort of where are your teams evacuated, who's not, who's missed. That's going to be harder to do. So I think that the work from home is going to put a lot more pressure on HR and others to know where physical presence is. And you're seeing this in companies, sort of like, where are people? None of this is new, and this is like we used to do this big, you know, on travel logs, like where is Elisa today? Oh, she's in you know, France or Germany. You know, where are you? Yeah. The second is, of course, cybersecurity. That the pressure on the network is going to be greater, and I think you have to assume some sort of breach or disruption of that network, and then what would you do in response to that? I don't know I don't know where you are on sort of the legacy of work from home.
I think hybrid is here to stay. I know we have been rewriting plans for companies at an extraordinary rate to accommodate what does a hybrid crisis management team look like, and how to work in hybrid ways. And you know, I think we're going to get good at it. I think it's just going to take a little bit of time, like any change.
Yeah, I think that's right.
What about when a crisis hits, can you apologize without it becoming an admission of guilt? That is my favorite question to answer. So huge thanks to whoever asked that. You take it. Do you want to take it first?
No, you take it if it's your favorite question. I'm always curious your answer. I learned so much.
You're much too kind. So when a crisis hits, can you apologize without it becoming an admission of guilt? Yes, absolutely. Unequivocally so. Like, there is just no other way around it. So firstly, let's talk about apologies. Apologies do not mean guilt, do not mean responsibility, do not mean liability. Proportionate apologies are even more important, right? We apologize in a way that is commensurate with the size of the situation at hand, right? We do not grovel when it's not required. Otherwise, it comes out as insincere. So it definitely has to be a very, very measured. What can you apologize for? You can apologize for the suffering, for the anxiety, for the allegations, for the situation, for the awfulness. You can apologize for all those things without admitting any sort of guilt or responsibility for that. And you must, because that is that huge part of concern that we spoke about. What do you think, Juliet?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely right. I find it so odd that this is, like, in some ways that this is the question, because I think it is the sort of the lawyers and others sort of being worried. You don't have to admit Chances are you don't even know, right? I mean, chances are you don't know where the liability, if you're thinking just about legal liability,
That's right.
and at that stage, but you could certainly know that this sucks for others, not for you. We say there's no I in crisis, which is a joke, but you know, the idea, like, empathy is not about how you're feeling, like, you know, I want my life back, or I'm, you know, stressed out. It's about you recognizing how others are feeling. And there's little tactics, not so much, but like I learned from one of my mentors. He, you know, especially operations tend to get into chain of command. So this person has to talk to that person and that person, like you can't reach up. And he used to just occasionally just pick up a phone and ask for the phone number of the 21-year-old, you know, line officer who did an overnight because the president was arriving and they needed to make sure that everything was okay. And I would just pick up the phone and call them for half a minute and just say thank you. And like that thing, right? It's, you know, I recognize how horrible this is or how stressful this is, whatever, that thing becomes essential, because communication is not just covering yourself, right? Oh, I have to show empathy. It actually is an engagement, right? It actually gets people invested in the success of the response, and they want to help. Right, people. That's why I think you and I are probably generally happy people, in the sense that like you actually see that people are generally good.
For sure. So I see the title of your book, right?
Yes.
The Devil Never Sleeps. So this question is definitely for you. Are crises happening more often, or are we just in a more crisis-aware world?
Yeah, both. Both. Well, I think we define crisis broadly. As you said at the beginning, that a crisis is something that cuts to the sort of core capability of a company. But both sort of number-wise, in terms of the number of what you might say over $1 billion natural disasters here in the United States, is how we might define it. There used to be 2 a year 10 years ago. There's now 17 a year. You can just look at the numbers and say. But I also think our connectivity also means that that there are greater crises, so that a ransomware attack at a distribution facility in Georgia against Colonial Pipeline becomes a supply chain challenge in northern New England as they try to get oil from a distribution company that had to shut down because of a ransomware attack. So all of the above, but I think one of the benefits of sort of the historical approach is there's been disasters. We're not, you know, in for a long time. We certainly know that. And whether pandemics or not cyber, but others and others attacks, and their commonalities and consistencies are actually what we should take away. But I, you know, depending on how you define disaster, the answer is yes.
Certainly. Well, I think that nicely leads on to what types of organizations are most at risk from crises at the moment. I would sort of turn that answer on its head and be like, it's not a type of organization, it's what you have intrinsically happening inside your organization that is going to make you more prone to crises. And to me, if we define a crisis as something that, you said, Juliet, cuts to the core, and I love that, then an organization most at risk of a crisis is one that has insufficient prioritization of its risks of integrity. The way we do business, the way we run our supply chain, our culture inside our organization, the equality, sort of the every part of being a good company run by good humans, when that becomes systemically challenged, you will have a crisis. And I think putting those risks of integrity as high or higher than operational risks to a degree, I mean, depending on what kind of company you run, is what's going to make you less prone to a crisis.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I think it's not, look, any, I mean, the example I just used is a company called Colonial Pipeline, which is 800 people. It's all it's doing is making sure pipelines are working in the East Coast of the U.S. It had what would best be described as sort of a lame ransomware attack, and because it had not prepared, ended up having to close down its entire system for about a week. You can worry about the BPs and the Boeings, and those become the big stories. But it actually turns out that the vulnerability has to do with your preparedness, right? Because those ransomware attacks are happening all the time without systems shutting down. Yeah. So I tend to focus, like you, less on sort of the who and that the sort of inevitable what.
Certainly. So we only have a few minutes left. I think we can probably take a couple more questions.
Okay, great. We'll be quick.
And thank our listeners. This one, I think, is certainly worth looking at. How prepared is the USA and Western nations from an interagency perspective if or when hit by a series of cyber attacks? For example, the Russian Navy is ordered by the Kremlin to torpedo critical undersea cable that handles large amount of internet traffic affecting financial transactions.
We're in trouble. I mean, as I said, we have not built redundancy. So in those instances, you're going to want to focus on prevention and preparedness, and I mean prevention and protection. The same is true of nuclear, that the consequences of it are so grave. On the other challenge we have is we don't have a socialized critical infrastructure, a public critical infrastructure. 80% of our critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector, so we're incredibly dependent on them to get their act together. That's why you hear the Biden administration constantly saying, you know, check your networks, check your systems. We've decided to not regulate that. So I'm a big fan of government increasing the floor for safety and security. We tend not to do that. So there are vulnerabilities there. So that part of the responsibility then is, okay, well, how can you stop the cascading losses because the vulnerability is likely to be abused or manipulated by an adversary. So it is, and it's different per country.
Yeah. Those larger, very large crises always bring the scariest thoughts, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Judah, is there anything else?
No, I think this is great. Thank you so much. That's so fun. And also just like, yeah, I took lots of notes off of you, so I'll be using them. It's wonderful. And thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you all. Thank you, colleagues, all for tuning in. Wishing you a really great rest of the day and rest of the afternoon. And do go, you know, check those crisis definitions, look at those plans, and hopefully take some of the actions that we have been talking about.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.